This class is called Yishmael, Esau, and Us. And we want to take a deeper understanding of what's going on here. If you look at the media, then the media is talking about politics and about armed conflicts, about terrorism, about the Middle East, about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's talking about peoples. It's talking about states or political entities. It's talking about armies, militants or terrorists. And it's talking about current events and what's going on. What it almost entirely does not address is the fact that there is a religious substratum to all of this. It's rarely, if at all, addressed by the media. The terrorists who conducted the massacre 8 days ago, they shouted a phrase constantly, again and again. They shouted Allahu Akbar, which in Arabic means God is great. It wasn't a one person, it wasn't one time event, it was constantly. They kept chanting it as they were doing all their horrible things. They did it in the name of God, which in Arabic is called Allah, which simply means God. And Allahu Akbar means God is great. In Hebrew also we have a very similar word, Kabir. Kabir is great. And when they refer to Jews, they don't say Israelis. They sometimes say Zionists. But the main word they use is Yahud, which is Jews, which has to do with Yahadut, Judaism or Yiddishkeit, which in their eyes goes along with their religion. They know it's not just a people. It's a people and a belief system and a faith. It goes together. One of the most meaningful moments in my life was actually, very ironically, interestingly, it happened in Gaza. Many years ago, I went to Gaza as part of a kind of left-wing tour of the place. We were brought in to see the refugee camps, to see the horrible state in which the Palestinian refugees, or really the second generation, now it's the third generation, of the refugees from 1948, how they live. If you don't know this, this is an unprecedented state in the entire world, that the refugee status has moved from the actual refugees to their descendants. Because the Palestinian authorities made sure that they do not come out of their camps and that they remain in that terrible living conditions in order to show off to people how badly they live. And I was exactly on one of those tours. Interestingly, that tour, which was supposed to make me more of a leftist, was actually instrumental, or was one more stage in me sort of opening up into more right-wing thinking, which before that I totally saw as sort of wrong or evil. And one of the things that I saw there was that I saw the refugee camps, and it is a very sordid kind of living conditions. I also saw that the heads of the Palestinian of the PLO that was at the time ruling them, they lived in amazing, beautiful mansions very nearby. They took care of themselves, but they didn't take care of the refugees. Another thing I saw was that they built a very big sort of cultural center, like with a theater and a gallery. And they had money coming in, but they put it into other things. And then we went into this cultural sort of place, and then we saw an exhibition of paintings or drawings by little Palestinian children. And it was all about the settlers and how the settlers and the army and about the occupation. But one of the things that struck me that totally surprised me was that they drew all the Jews with black suits and black hats and the pails coming out of the sides of their... Now, this is the kind of Jew that they've never seen. They've seen settlers. They don't look like that. Settlers have different kippot and different... They dress differently. They don't have the black suits. And I realized they're using the icon of the Jew. They're using the icon of the ultra-Orthodox Jew. Although the people that they saw were mostly secular soldiers and national religious people, in their opinion, Jews are ultra-Orthodox. Jews are only very religious Jews. This is what Jews are. Or soldiers. And that struck me very odd. I realized that they see the religion, not just the people. And many years later, we have a journalist here in Israel who works on TV. He's a reporter. He knows perfect Arabic, and he's a reporter on the Arab states and their politics. And one day he interviewed a terrorist, and he interviewed him. And the terrorist asked him, "What are you?" So he told him, "I'm a human being, and then I'm also an Israeli. And I'm also a little bit part of the Arab world because I have good Arabic and I cover the Arabic world." And then the terrorist told him, "You can add, above that list, you can add idiot. That's above all the other things you said, you're an idiot." He says, "Why?" He says, "Because when I'm going to kill you, I'm not going to say I killed an Israeli. I'm not going to say I killed a human being. I'm not going to say I killed an Arab. I'm going to say I killed a Jew." And that moved him to the point that he started reconnecting to his Jewish roots. The point of all this very roundabout introduction is that there is a religious substratum to what's going on. We can't understand it just by talking about politics and Palestinians and Israelis and the conflict in the Middle East. We have to talk about Judaism and Islam. And also, as we'll see, not now, but later on, Christianity has to be part of this thing also, because it's part of the history of these two titanic religions that in different ways grew out of Judaism. So in the time remaining, I want to point out three amazing facts. And I'm just going to list these three amazing facts, and then we'll take a week to let those facts sink in. You know those facts. Everyone knows those facts. But they're not often enough put together we need to hang them on the wall and sort of think about them very deeply every day and what they mean. Okay, so amazing fact number one. The biggest religion in the world today is Christianity. The world population right now is about 7.8 billion people. The current Christian population in the world is almost 2.4 billion. 2.4 out of 7.8 is more than a third. It's almost a quarter. That doesn't make sense what I said. It's about a third. It's something massive. It's more than a quarter and almost a third. Am I right? Do the math afterwards. The second biggest religion in the world is Islam. It wasn't, by the way, the second biggest religion 30 years ago. That was Hinduism. Islam is also the fastest growing religion. Over the past 30 years, it bypassed Hinduism and it became the second biggest religion in the world. It has about 1.8 billion followers. Together, 1.8 billion Muslims and 2.4 billion Christians, you have 4.2 billion people, which is more than half the world population. It's noticeably more than half of the world population. And the amazing thing here is that all these people see themselves as walking in the footsteps of one man whose name was Abraham. They see themselves as the true followers or descendants of Abraham, who are continuing on his journey. So there was this one person about 3,700 years ago, whose name was Abraham, and he had a blessing. He was blessed by Hashem to be the father of many nations. And right now, this is reality. He is the father, in many ways, of many nations, and more than half of the world population, noticeably more, sees itself as walking in the footsteps of Abraham. Of course, they disagree on what he exactly had in mind, but they want to be his true followers. And the name Abraham or Ibrahim and other names of his descendants in the other generations, like Joseph or Yusuf, or like Moses or Musa, or like Solomon or Suleiman, they're all widespread by the millions and billions all over the world. So this is amazing fact number one. And in fact, it's even more amazing when you see how these two religions came about, because both of them came about in events that were completely unforeseeable. Now, some events you can foresee. There was a science fiction novel by Isaac Asimov called Foundation. And he had this kind of mathematician, this genius mathematician, who comes up with a system called, he calls it psychohistory, and he analyzes the psychology of masses. And it takes in all the data of all the galaxy, all the planets, all the peoples, all the religions, all the civilizations, and it puts them into this giant computer and algorithm, and then it can foresee the future millennia ahead with amazing precision, because he can tell how masses are going. He studied the laws of history. However, as the plot goes on, it's a few volumes, a series, something happens that he couldn't foresee, because it had to do with a unique individual, and he had no insight into the psychology of individuals. If you have a unique individual, that upends all of the system of psychohistory. So both these religions, that mathematician from that science fiction book could not have foreseen. He could have foreseen a lot of things. You can foresee. There are dynamics that are repeated in the way empires rise and fall, and there's books about this today, and there are dynamics that repeat themselves. Both these religions came about in events that are completely unforeseeable. So one of them was that around the 4th century AD or CE, the mother of the Roman emperor traveled to the land of Israel, to Palestine as they called it, and then she came across this tiny sect of, we can call them Reform Jews, or a kind of sect that sort of steered away from Orthodox Judaism. And they called themselves the Christians. They were a tiny sect. They were persecuted both by Jews and Romans. Nobody liked them. And they lived in the desert. And she stumbled upon one of them, and she started chatting with him. And she sort of fell in love and became a believer of this tiny Jewish sect that was also addressing non-Jews. And she was enamored by this, went back home to Rome and talked her son into stopping the persecutions, and later on into turning that tiny little sect of Jews into the official religion of the Roman Empire. Hence, Christianity started its journey onto becoming the biggest religion in the world. That's something you absolutely cannot foresee. It's like a fluke. It's like a crazy, crazy fluke that, in a way, you have to say that the hand of God was here in some way. Although, as strange as this may seem coming from a Jew, we'll understand this more as we continue on our journey into understanding these two religions. 300 years later, which is 600 years after Jesus, who began that sect of Christianity, we have another event that's totally, totally unforeseeable. We have an illiterate Arab merchant who lives in Mecca, which is a very backwards merchant's town, in a very backwards place that's outside of the biggest empires. He's not part of the Byzantine Empire. They're not part of the Persian Empire. They don't have agriculture. They're merchants and bandits, basically. And they're pagan. They're all very pagan. Christianity is there a little bit. Judaism is there a little bit because Jews have dispersed. We're talking 7th century. An illiterate Arab merchant comes out of a cave and says that he had a divine revelation, starts gathering a few people around him. For 10 years, they're also sort of persecuted as being this kind of weird people who believe in an invisible God, because he starts basically believing in the God of the Bible and the God of Jews and Christians. And then he has a stroke of luck that he's invited to another town to be the ruler. He becomes the ruler, and over the next 12 years, he conducts many raids on other groups in the Arabian Peninsula, and basically takes over the whole Arab Peninsula, and lives a kind of legacy, a kind of will, that his new religion that he called Islam, it needs to take over the world. And the moment he passes away, the fastest conquest in his world history begins. And in about 100 years, an empire stretching from Spain to India is governing a massive amount of land, and becomes, in the 20th century, the second biggest religion in the world, Islam. No one could have foreseen that you would have this sect coming out of Jesus and suddenly becoming the official religion of Rome. Nobody could foresee that this kind of person from the Arabian Peninsula would start a religion that would so quickly become so massive and rule the world and have a caliphate for 1400 years and still hold sway over billions of people. So that's just amazing fact number one. Now we come to amazing fact number two. Amazing fact number two is that long before Muhammad and long before Jesus, in the time of Abraham himself, as the future Jewish people is coming into being, as is told in the Torah, we see that it doesn't start and end with Abraham. We need three generations. Only with the grandson is the name Israel given, and all children of this grandson are the beginning of the tribes of the people of Israel. We had to take three generations for some reason. And that's why on Passover we say Shlosha mi yoda, Shlosha ani yoda, Shlosha avot. What is the meaning of three? Three is three patriarchs. Why is it three generations? It's three generations because Abraham has two sons. The first is called Ishmael, and he cannot be the successor. He's not the son of the wife, he's the son of the handmaid, and he's misbehaving, and there's a prophecy that he needs to be taken away from the family. He's given a lot of blessings. He's the son of Abraham. He's blessed. He's not a Noahide. He's not part of the 70 nations. He's the descendant of Abraham. He needs to have a lot of blessings to give him on his journey, on his way, but he's taken away from the lineage. And Isaac, the second born, that is born out of the mistress, not the handmaid, continues. But he also has two children, this time from the same wife. He has twins, Esau and Jacob. But Esau misbehaves, and he sells the status of being the eldest. And he refuses to continue, and the blessing, the torch, goes to the second son. And he is also sort of pushed away from the lineage with many, many blessings for success in his future career. Ishmael is the father of the Arab nation where Muhammad came from. Esau is the father of the Edomites, but according to Jewish tradition, the founders of Rome were Edomites. So the Roman Empire descends from Esau, and the Roman Empire is the empire that took on Christianity as its religion. So long, long, long before Christianity came into the world and Islam came into the world, a very, very, in the DNA of the Torah, it says that after we have Abraham, and Abraham is on one side of the river of the world, and the rest of humanity is on the other side of the river of the world. He's the first monotheist. He is outside of the 70 nations and regular pagan worship and idol worship. He has two descendants that are, they don't follow in his path, in the sort of official path. They go out with blessings of good fortune. And out of them, eventually, centuries, more than 1,000 years later, these two religions come about. In a different order. That's an interesting thing that we're going to have to look at. Because the first religion to grow comes out of Esau, who is the grandson of Abraham, and then the second religion to appear comes out of Ishmael, who is the son of Abraham. So that's something interesting to think about, but that's not going to be now. This is amazing fact number two. Now we have amazing fact number three. It's more local. It has to do with us Jews. We went into a first diaspora and then came back, and then the second temple was destroyed, and the second diaspora began. And eventually, not immediately, but eventually, first it was mostly around Babylon, all kinds of places, but the diaspora grew and grew, and Jews became more and more distant. And eventually, Jews went and lived under two different diasporas, very different. There are the Jews who lived in the Christian lands, and we call them Ashkenazi Jews. And there are Jews that lived under the Muslim rule in the Islamic states, and we call them now Sephardic Jews. They developed very different customs, very different styles of music, of Torah learning, of commentary, different, totally different vibes in terms of their customs and their energy. They intermingled, they converted some people into their people, so they have different skin color mostly. And now they're coming back together. They're coming back together. In Israel, they're coming back together all over the world because we're now living in a global village. The two religions that grew out of Judaism became two hothouses for Judaism itself to grow and be influenced by those two civilizations or religions, only to be later reunited and to bring with them all kinds of things that they picked up in those two hothouses, those two spaces. Because it's very easy to see that the Ashkenazi Jewry was influenced by Christianity. You just have to go into a typical Ashkenazi shul, and you see some similarities to churches. And you have to go to a Sephardic shul, and you see some similarities to mosques. And if you listen to the language and the way of thinking and the style of thinking, they were shaped by those two civilizations that are not Jewish, but theologically, historically, they grew out of Abraham. They all follow the God of Abraham. So this is amazing fact number three, in a way, that we had to go through and live under those two religions in order to, what we call now in Kabbalistic terminology, in order to elevate sparks. There were sparks of holiness, wholly lost sparks in those two massive great civilizations that we had to be there and be immersed in them in some way, get to know them, familiarize ourselves with them in a way without mixing ourselves, because we're Jews and we have the Torah and it's totally forbidden to become a Christian or a Muslim, but we had to be there, and it influenced us in a very deep way. And the fact that Ashkenazi Jews and Sephardic Jews are now coming together and mingling and talking and becoming friends and marrying is, in a way, a reclaiming of all kinds of sparks and energy and bits and pieces of content and melody and style and way of thinking that developed in those two great civilizations. So this is something very, very interesting to think about. These three amazing facts. And if we don't dedicate enough thought to this, we're pretty clueless about what's going on in the world. And I'm going to add one final thing. If you Google the word monotheism, and then you click on image search, you will see many, many versions of a diagram that has a cross, a crescent, and the Star of David, right? Sometimes the Star of David would be in the middle, sometimes the cross would be in the middle, sometimes the crescent would be in the middle, and then you can pretty much tell who made the diagram. But when you think about this, something is very odd here. There are 2.4 billion Christians. There are 1.8 billion Muslims. How many Jews are there? Oh, yeah, 16 million. 16 million is a fifth of a percent of humankind. It's 0.02%. 0.2%, sorry. Fifth of a percent. And not all of them are religious. If you think about religious Jews, then it's at the max, it's half. And many people would say it's just 20%. So it's a fifth of that. So it's 0.004%, if I'm not mistaken. So the question that I have, but you know what? Let's assume all Jews are religious and observant, and you know, amech kulam tzadikim, where everyone is deeply, fervently believing Jew. Then it's still only a fifth of a percent. So my question is, why is the Star of David? Why does it even appear in the basic universal diagram of monotheism and Abrahamic religions, as they're called? It shouldn't be there. It doesn't make any sense. There's no reason that it should be there. You only need a cross and a crescent, because they're massive religions. There's also this little people called the Jewish people, and some of them uphold the Jewish religion. It's like a fly on the wall, really. There's another monotheistic religion. It's called Sikhism. It's not a biblical monotheistic religion. It doesn't come from the Bible. It's not the God of Abraham, but it's monotheistic. They have 20 to 30 million followers. That's more than us. We shouldn't even be there. The Star of David shouldn't be there. It doesn't make sense. So why is it there? The reason it's there, everyone knows this, but nobody is saying this. The reason it's there is that we wouldn't have a cross and a crescent without it. Those two religions would never have existed. They owe their existence to the fact that there was before them a religion called Judaism, which compiled the Bible, and collected all its stories and preserved all its stories, and that led to Christianity, and it also led to Quran. The Quran contains quite a few biblical stories in other versions of them. It comes out. Islam is a continuation. It's an inheritor of Christianity, which sees itself as the inheritor of Judaism. Right? Islam sees itself as the inheritor of Judaism and Christianity. So the reason the Star of David is there is that that's the first monotheistic religion, and the other two grew out of it. So wait. So that means that the three symbols have nothing to do with size, because size-wise, we shouldn't be there. So it's not a quantity thing. It's a quality thing. It's qualitative reason, not a quantitative reason, right? Because in terms of size, the Star of David doesn't merit to be there. It's too tiny a religion. Oh, wait. So now, if it's all about quality, it's about the content and the substance and the story, then who says that the right way to put them is on the same size and on the same level, on the same plane? Because as two of them are massive, one of them is tiny, but still merited to be there because it has some important merit. It's the father of both of them. It's the mother of both of them. So here comes one of the biggest, in a way, lies of modern culture. The symbol of monotheism is deceiving. It gives the impression that these three religions are siblings. They're three brothers or sisters, sister religions. There's a book by a religious historian called Karen Armstrong. It's called History of God. And she has three circles that cross each other and they're the three religions. No, I'm sorry. If you're talking about either the Star of David shouldn't be there at all because it's too tiny, or if it is there, then admit that the reason that it's there is because it's not three sisters. It's a mother and two daughters. With the two daughters becoming incredibly big, because they tried to be. Judaism never tried to be so big. It didn't try to proselytize to the nations. But the other two did. So we have a tiny mother and two very, very big daughters. But it's a mother and a daughter. So if the diagram doesn't have anything to do with quantity or size, then the Star of David should be on top as the mother, and the star and the cross and the crescent should be at the bottom as two descendants coming out of it, like a second generation of an attempt to bring the monotheistic faith that's in the Star of David to the world in some way. So that's something that we are going to have to think about very, very deeply. Why does the world pretend that it's three sisters, whereas in reality it's a mother and two daughters? And if it's in reality it's a mother and two daughters, what does that tell us about those religions and about the history of the world and about what's going on here in the world now? And you'll see that the term that I use for this entire session, the eye of the storm, has another meaning. There's a big storm that's been raging for 600 years. There's a big, big ongoing battle between Islam and the West. And we are at the eye of the storm of this conflict. Because Islam and Christianity have very little in common, but each one of them has very much in common with us. We're the nexus of these two massive religions. We may also prove to be the key to resolving this global conflict. I leave you with that until next week. This video was made possible through the kind support of my sponsors over at Patreon. Patreon is a great way to help independent creators like myself produce original content. If you'd like to get more English language videos from me, please consider becoming a supporter via Patreon. You can find the link in the description below. Thank you very much.